I'm Sean Graham, and what's all this news this week are airports. In particular, the airport in the beautiful city of San Francisco, California, which goes by the call letters of SFO. It's an airport that I am familiar with. I've gone through it a few times. I've been fortunate enough to spend some time in San Francisco in my life as well, going in through SFO, transferred through there a couple times. It's an interesting airport geographically in that if you're going from the East Coast of North America, there are a lot of people who lay over there on their way to places in Western South America, in Hawaii, or in Asia as well. So in addition to being a airport for a major city in the West Coast, so it is a very busy airport. And what's interesting about SFO, or really any airport, are the power dynamics that shape their history. In the 21st century, airports have become essential. Really, you saw that during the pandemic, that even when everything else was shut down, airports were still going. Fewer passengers, for sure, but air cargo needed to go. Individuals working in essential services that have to travel, those were still going on. Families being connected and reconnected through air travel, that the airports never did fully shut down, despite a significant decrease in travelers. And that despite their importance in the modern world, they are often sites of contention, whether it's through noise, pollution, congestion. There are a lot of debates about airports. I know if you are familiar with the Island Airport in Toronto, there were a lot of questions about whether or not jets should be allowed at that airport, whether they should extend the runway to allow for jets. That ultimately has not happened. And there's still, though, concerns of new mandatory safety measures at the end of the runways that had to be added, that some people are wondering if that is the first step towards lengthening the runway. So airports are sites of contention, sites of power, and a lot of significant municipal debate happens around the airport. And that is the subject of a wonderful new book by Eric Porter entitled The People's History of SFO, The Making of the Bay Area Airport, in which Eric goes through and traces the history of not only the airport, but the land that the airport sits on from before there was an airport. And he traces the development of the airport as the city grows. And he looks at questions of power and who has agency in the debates and discussions about the airport, the individuals who live around the site, what say do they have in the development of the airport, policies that are put into place. But he also gets into questions of power as it relates to the travelers themselves, people who are coming to San Francisco from other parts of the world, and the questions that are associated with power dynamics in terms of immigration, border control. These questions are all playing out at the airport in San Francisco. And it's a really wonderful way, I think, to look at history, to look at the local history of a place by studying its airport and the development of its airport. Because as I said, airports have become so important and so central in the 21st century that studying them and studying their development is a very unique lens into a city. And I will admit, I like airports too. I find them interesting. I like looking at where all the planes are going, looking at the board of the departures and the arrivals. And even just sitting in the airport, I find somehow relaxing, certainly more relaxing than being on an airplane. So when this came out, I saw it, and it was one that I definitely wanted to go through and have Eric on the podcast. And fortunately, he was nice enough to join me. And I really enjoyed the conversation. Hope you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Eric Porter. Eric Porter joins me now. Eric, how are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing really well. Very excited to have you here to talk about a people's history of SFO, the making of the Bay Area and an airport. So Eric, before we get into some of the specifics that are in the book, we talked about this just a little bit before we started to record. But what made you want to write a book about an airport?
Good question. Lots of different factors. I mean, I had been wanting to write a history of the Bay Area Since as long as I've been doing this academic work, I wasn't quite sure what form it would take, but it was there in the back of my mind. I had been doing some work recently on urban history in other places, urban history of other places. And I should back up and say that I'm from the Bay Area originally. So, I wanted to write about home, even though I'd written about these other places. And in terms of the airport, I mean, as we were talking about earlier, I just think they're interesting places that reflect in different ways the places where they're situated. I also have a bit of family history regarding SFO. My grandfather worked there as a skycap beginning in the early 1940s, and that job is what brought his family, my father's family, to the Bay Area as part of the second great migration at that moment in time. And so I've been interested in that because of the family, interested in the site SFO because of the family connection. So I don't know, there are different factors. At some point I had a dream about finding an unknown volume by, I think it was C.L.R. James, on the London Railway Station. So I woke up thinking, it'd be interesting to write about the Bay Area vis-a-vis SFO. But I didn't think about it beforehand, obviously.
Yeah. And how does one go about writing about an airport? Because you're writing about a really long period of time. Like you're going before there's actually an airport there. You're looking at the territory, the land on which the airport sits, and taking it through the era where there's the airport there. So how do you go about doing that? Is there an archive on the airport, or looking at city files or FAA stuff? Like how are you putting this all together? What's the approach when you first start the project?
Yeah, well, multifaceted. The approach is multifaceted, and I drew upon different archives, including those that you mentioned. So some of it was just trial and error, trying to figure out what's out there, right? City files. San Francisco has a lot of documents related to the creation of operation of the airport that are easily available. There's an airport commission that has been running the airport for decades. And before that, it was a public utilities commission, and records for both of those entities are available. Local archives in the municipal archives in the cities surrounding the airport, including San Francisco, but then also the smaller cities that are closer to the airport have information on the facility. SFO has its own archive. There's a one of the things I write about in the book is SFO Museum, which is a sort of research and curatorial unit that for about four decades has been creating these cultural historical installations in the airport to make travelers give them a sense of the region's history and give travelers something to do as they're waiting for flights or are walking through the causeways, trying to kill time. But they also have a research, they have an archive there that's available for people who want to write about the airport or things aviation. And I think which also provides services to the city when it is, making, doing various construction projects related to the airport. So, they're very accommodating, and I know have assisted other academic researchers as well.
And is that located physically, or the SFO archive, is it physically at the airport?
Yeah, it's physically at the airport. Wow. in the international terminal. There's the SFO Museum headquarters is this, it's a space that is designed to look like the terminal, actually going back to when the airport was called Mills Field, a terminal built in the 1930s, and they have different displays there, and there's a reading room there, and then behind the scenes is are the archival spaces where one can do the research.
So it's all the thrill of archival research matched with the joy of getting to the airport. A dream scenario there.
The parking's more expensive.
So for anyone who hasn't been out to San Francisco or the Bay Area, where is the airport relative to the city? So if I'm at any of the signature sites that you would associate with San Francisco, where is the airport relative to that?
So the airport is actually about a dozen miles south of downtown San Francisco in San Mateo County. It sits on the edge of San Francisco Bay, on the western edge of the bay, and it's situated next to a couple of smaller cities, Burlingame, Millbrae, South San Francisco, San Bruno.
And is it in San Francisco proper, or who has the jurisdiction, or is it its own little thing?
So it's owned and operated by the city of San Francisco, but it sits in a different county. So San Francisco is in, is the city and county of San Francisco, and the airport sits in San Mateo County, which is just to the south.
Okay. So as you mentioned, it's south of San Francisco, and I said earlier that you start this book before there's the actual airport there, and you get into the significance of this land from the colonial perspective, the site of trade and mining in the region. So I'm really curious about that, and one, why you wanted to start there, but more importantly, what significance did this plot of land have for people in the area prior to there being an airport?
Okay, so I'll start with the first part of what you asked, and why there. I mean, I was sort of motivated by the fact that some of the existing histories of the airport, things produced by the city or by the airport themselves, or some of the journalistic coverage, historical journalistic coverage that I read about the facility, starts with the land upon which it was built. And usually the narrative goes something like, here was this difficult piece of land, very muddy. I mean, the airport's built on reclaimed salt marsh, right? So reclaimed tideland. So here's this muddy expanse of land. There wasn't anything there. And look at this wondrous thing that was built by through the heroic efforts by visionary city planners and boosters and engineers and various people who are involved with the air industry. So, following those narratives, I thought it also might make sense to start with the land upon which the airport was built, start with the site itself. I mean, I was interested in sort of connecting the history of the airport to the broader history of the Bay Area. I mean, this is as much a history of the Bay Area as it is a history of an airport. And, I was interested in, the colonial and imperial relationships that defined the region historically. So I thought it would be interesting to go back further in time to sort of think about, explore some of the foundations, colonial imperial foundations that made the Bay Area, and how they may have shaped this one piece of land upon which this airport was eventually built that played its own role in shaping the Bay Area. So, who lived there beforehand and worked on this land? I mean, it was originally inhabited, lived on by Ramaytush Ohlone people for millennia before Europeans arrived. And there were, because the airport site was, initially was, because the airport was built on marshland, the indigenous villages were, a bit distant from the current site, but those tidelands were used by the indigenous people hunted on them, fished on them, foraged plants and shellfish from them. And then, after they were displaced, taken to the indigenous people, the Ohlone people who lived in proximity to the airport were all, if they didn't die from European diseases or European brought diseases, were taken to the mission in San Francisco before the end of the 18th century. And, after that, those lands became part of the mission's holdings, actually. So the mission and the San Francisco Presidio grazed cattle in and around the area. And then that land was, after the mission system ended, was sold to a Californio Spanish rancher, and Sanchez, whose family owned the land, and he grazed cattle. His family grazed cattle on it, and then was built. Then it was eventually bought by a wealthy Anglo banker, Darius Ogden Mills, who made a fortune through his own bank and then later as a principal of the Bank of California, financing gold and silver mining in the Sierra Nevada, among other things. So his family owned the property for, I guess, over half a century. He ended up reclaiming the marshland and turning it into dry land by building, actually hiring Chinese laborers to build a levee around it. And he turned it into pasture land because he was, you know, in addition to being a wealthy banker, was a, I guess a, you'd call him a gentleman farmer, and he raised dairy cows on the land. So anyway, he through his dairying operation, he transformed the land as well.
So what does that story, which is really interesting, the sort of the progression of the land, I think it's so cool that you went back and traced that, the history of the specific location of the airport. But when you get into Mills and his story and purchasing the land, and really it is a story about dispossession and colonization, as you talk about in the book, is there any connection or what connection is there between that colonial story of the land and then the airport itself in terms of just, I'm thinking like the imagery of that, or it strikes me that these things are pretty interconnected just from a symbolic perhaps perspective, but I'm wondering if you had the same reaction as you were going through it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in power. Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in, you know, how people, I mean, you know, the kinds of relationships that are shaped by systems and power that, you know, have defined systems of power that have defined the Bay Area, made the Bay Area, you know, and really complicated human interactions that are shaped by various processes, colonial, imperial processes. Yeah, there's a connection in the sense that I was interested in, you know, creating this foundational story, investigating this foundational story of human relationships on this place, that you then as a way of that on some level anticipate the you know, in a sense, a more complicated set of relationships that happened on this site once the airport is built, and that particular place is connected to other places, not only across the Bay Area, but across the globe.
Yeah. And when you talk about, like, you know, the importance of something like mining and the, like, really colonialism is the initial process of globalization. And in the 21st century, what's perhaps a better sign of our global world than airports, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it does seem like there's this real interconnection there. So I'm wondering, once we get to the point where we're into the 20th century and, all right, we're flying around, the Wright brothers have done their thing, planes are safe enough that we need to build airports, why is this location ultimately selected for an airport?
So there are, there had been a history of aviation in San Francisco, you know, going back to 1910s, I guess. There had been a small municipal airport on the northern edge of San Francisco, for people who know the city where the marina is now. And then that site ultimately became unworkable because of the weather conditions there. It was just too foggy, among other things. And then, you know, it wasn't big enough. As planes started to grow, the landing field wasn't really big enough to accommodate them. So initially the profit from commercial aviation was from airmail, as opposed to transporting people and more substantial cargo. I mean, through the 1920s and into the beginnings of the 1930s. So once that initial airport was no longer workable, the terminus for the airmail route, and this is like the transcontinental air mail route, was moved to the East Bay, to the city called Concord, and was there for a while. But then San Francisco really wanted it back because they just wanted more proximity to the end of the terminus. And, you know, because this route was, you know, the airmail business, and people anticipated the future, a future with commercial aviation and more substantial transport of cargo. They just thought that this would should be closer to San Francisco and should benefit. For convenience and for profitability, the terminus should be closer to the city. So they were looking for other places, and there just wasn't a viable place by that point because of the growth of the city and because of geographical considerations. There hadn't been there just wasn't a viable place within the city, and they were looking at different places south of the city, and they're also looking at other East Bay sites too. And in part because the San Francisco city officials and boosters were worried about the East Bay and Oakland in particular sort of overtaking San Francisco as the primary Bay Area city. If the airport got relocated there, they opted to build it in San Mateo County, which was not San Francisco, but closer, and there wasn't another major city in San Mateo County. So there was, so one thing led to another, and because of a combination of weather conditions and proximity, this particular site was chosen. And the land was cheap too. The Mills family, there was various proposals from different landowners to situate the airport on their land, and the Mills family leased the land to the city at a pretty reasonable rate.
Now, you mentioned Oakland, and one of the things I do have a question about is San Francisco and Oakland and sort of how the two cities relate to each other. But just as a starting point here, when they're deciding where to put the airport, you mentioned the growth of San Francisco. How many people are we talking about versus Oakland or elsewhere in the Bay Area in terms of where this airport could have been? And sort of where are we sort of foundationally, just to set the stage for the rest of the 20th century and the growth that surrounds the airport?
Oh, man, I can't remember the population at the time. I just don't know. But I mean, it's the biggest. I mean, San Francisco is the biggest city by far, right? And they want to keep it that way. And I guess another part of the equation is there's, at the time, it's interesting, there's LA, Los Angeles is not quite as big as it would become, and at this point in time, it's unclear which is going to be the dominant West Coast city, LA, San Francisco, or perhaps even Seattle. So there's some impetus to keep it close to home, keep the airmail terminus in San Francisco so as not to let Los Angeles displace it. But it's significantly, San Francisco is significantly larger than Oakland, although Oakland is a second city and it's growing, but San Francisco wants to keep it that way.
Relative to that, like, it's always dangerous, I know, and I shouldn't do this, to ask historians about like counterfactual history and what would happen. But in the history of the Bay Area, and I'll admit, I've been to the Bay Area once and I loved it. I had the pleasure of staying both in San Francisco and in Oakland. But in the past 10 years since I visited, I view the Bay Area entirely through sports. And all the teams from Oakland have left or are leaving, either for San Francisco or elsewhere. And it's very sad because I very much enjoyed going to the games that I went to in Oakland. But it strikes me that Oakland has always been, or has the reputation of being, kind of the younger brother who's always like scrappy and trying to catch up to big, glorious San Francisco. Is that reputation accurate? And is the airport a contributing factor in that, when we go back to this era and kind of cementing San Francisco's place as being maybe the dominant city in the Bay Area?
I mean, I think it's one factor among many. I mean, yes, Oakland has been a kind of, second city, little brother or sister to San Francisco on some level. And, scrapping for some measure of equality, or at least a larger share of the pie. Although, actually, in terms of population, San Jose, side of Silicon Valley, is actually numerically, in terms of population, larger than both cities. And then, given the sort of political and economic weight of Silicon Valley, has overtaken San. Well, maybe in terms of financial influence, overtaken, but not necessarily in terms of cultural influence, overtaken San Francisco. Yeah, it's interesting to think about counterfactually, like, what if the major airport had moved to Oakland? And that actually, people were worried that it might, because one of the things that happens soon after, you know, what becomes SFO is established in 1927 is that some of the early airlines operating out of the site get really disenchanted with it because of poor field conditions and bad weather, and move their operations over to Oakland.
Oh, wow.
And then eventually the city gets, San Francisco gets them back after a year or two, and then, you know, ends up, you know, making many more, and it's a long story, I'm not going into the details, but many more, is able to leverage a lot more money through municipal bonds and eventually federal funding and the like to sort of ensure that SFO becomes, or what becomes SFO becomes the major airport. But, you know, in the first years of the facility's operation, it wasn't clear that would have been the case. And if the airport had moved there and been situated, you know, near the end of the the Transcontinental Railroad, and if, you know, and eventually the port moves there too, I mean, you know, who knows what might have happened.
Yeah, the teams could be leaving San Francisco.
Maybe. Yeah. It would be such a sad sports story in the East Bay right now.
Yeah. So I want to jump ahead a little bit from the airport and its inception. I'm curious about the Second World War and what's going on, because obviously once the United States is in the war following Pearl Harbor, there's a lot of concern about Japan and what's coming from the Pacific. Is there anything related to the airport, or what precautions, or what does the Second World War look like for this airport in San Francisco, and how does it navigate that transition from the Depression and some of the struggles that we see for air travel through that period of the early 40s?
Yeah. Well, the war is good. I mean, war in general is good for airports, right? Good for civilian airports. I mean, even though the Depression is happening, I mean, it's the 1930s which really sees a significant growth of civilian aviation. I mean, there's a lot of New Deal funds put into building and revamping airports. I mean, part of the justification is that, you know, airports are good for the economy and good for trade. And, you know, airports are these massive infrastructures, and they need a lot of human bodies working on them to, you know, either build or expand them. So, you know, there's a lot of Public Works Administration and WPA projects dedicated to airport construction during the 1930s. And again, a lot of the times the justification for the federal expenditure of funds on them is that not only are these good for trade, but these can also be used for civilian defense, right? So what happens in the 1940s then is that, it's actually a complicated story, I'm going to try to be brief here. There's another airport, or another landing field at least, built on Treasure Island during the 1930s, and Treasure Island is a human built island in the middle of San Francisco Bay that becomes the site of the World's Fair, two expos, I think 1939 and 1940, if I remember correctly. And so there's this project proposed, federal funds are obtained for it, and basically the project is going to be, we're going to build this island, there's going to be an airport there, and then we're also going to hold this World's Fair there. And at that point in time, it's not clear whether this new airport's going to become the primary airport site for San Francisco, or whether it'll become something else, or whether perhaps this, or it's also possible the city might operate both sites. So anyway, this thing gets built. They hold the World's Fair. World War II happens. The military gets access to the site for a naval base, Treasure Island naval base, with the understanding that it's going to give the site back to the city at the conclusion of the war. But then the military decides to hold on to the site, and after going through a lot of back and forth, negotiations, legal proceedings, and the like with the city, they cut this deal by which the military will hang on to the Treasure Island air facility, and in part in exchange for that, will make these major improvements to the San Mateo County Airport. So it gets expanded dramatically. And so civilian aviation continues at the San Mateo site during World War II. at the same time that the military, Army and Navy, runs operations out of it, makes these huge improvements. And that, again, improves, expands the airport, and kind of provides a foundation for the growth of more rapid growth of commercial aviation after the war.
And so essentially at this point, we're not quite at jets and civil aviation yet, but they're ready for jets really by the mid, late 1940s?
Getting ready for jets. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, jets get introduced in the late 1950s, but civilian aviation really expands dramatically post-World War II because of a variety of factors, expanding economy, rapid growth in consumer spending, making eventually more reasonable costs vis-a-vis what people are earning, which makes air travel more obtainable, viable for a greater number of people.
Now, one of the things, though, that sort of comes up in the book and just in sort of civil aviation, the growth of civil aviation is bringing people to a place, right? So people can come to San Francisco. But I'm also curious about where are people going, right? So if you're in San Francisco, if you have some money, you want to travel, it's the 1950s, you got this airport, now it's expanded, civil aviation is expanding. What kind of destinations are available from San Francisco, and how is the airport, and how are those destinations kind of creating a network for the city that people can expand beyond just the Bay Area?
I mean, people are going to all kinds of different places, right? I mean, you know, it's lower cost aviation permits business travel to other West Coast locations. So you see a lot of that happening. A lot of travel to Los Angeles, a lot of travel to Seattle, you know, for pleasure, but also for doing business. You know, the 1950s see a pretty significant expansion of the tourism industry and, you know, facilitated through air travel. So SFO is a point of departure you see a rapid expansion of tourism in Mexico. So a lot of these Mexican tourist destinations farther south than border cities, they sort of rapidly grow and appeal to U.S.-based tourists during the 50s and beyond. As I understand it, places like Acapulco, Puerto Vallarta, sites like that, also see a rapid growth of tourism in the Hawaiian Islands. And San Francisco is well situated to as a jumping off point for trips to Hawaii. Going back to the 1930s, people who are promoting aviation in San Francisco saw it as a mechanism for expanded trade across the Pacific Rim, right? I mean, and again, that's part of how municipal, that was part of the justification for spending municipal funds on the airport. It's like, look, this will increase business opportunities across the Pacific Rim. So, you know, there's some tourism in Asia, in East Asia. There's tourism in Hawaii that are sort of ramping up during this period of time and you know, being marketed to Bay Area residents, as well as others in other parts of the country who might change planes in San Francisco.
And the Bay, I love old advertising, and the Bay Area, you could, tons of great posters about the Bay, right? Come visit the Bay. Like, there's so many beautiful sites in the Bay that can draw people in. And aviation is a huge part of that, because you can see those old like tin signs or posters that just really advertise the Bay. And is this an era where certainly San Francisco and the Bay Area is growing, but is there a direct correlation between the air travel, the increase in air travel, and the growth that we're seeing in the city?
I mean, I think that they facilitate one another. I mean, I think that as the population expands, there's more demand. You know, you have a growing population, which includes some reasonably well-to-do people who, you know, are flying more, and that provides justification for growing the flight, and, you know, it creates, demand for more flights in and out of the city. I think you also see, it's increasingly a tourist destination, you know, through this period as well. The economy is heating up, that spurs the growth in the airport, and you know, that's one among many factors in facilitating the economic growth in the city, alongside shipping and various industries that are being instituted.
We mentioned jets earlier. There's a whole chapter about jets and the introduction of jets and the noise associated with jets in the book. And you mentioned earlier that you're interested in power. So we don't necessarily need to talk about like the technology of jets, the import of jets to the aviation industry. I am curious though about the debate over the politics and the noise associated with jets, and in particular, who has agency in those discussions. So as you're looking at this era and the introduction of jets, whose voices are privileged in these debates and in these discussions?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story. So jets get instituted in the late 1950s. Propeller planes were loud enough, and there had been some complaints in neighborhoods surrounding the airport about the noise. And backing up a bit, I'll say that, you know, initially when they built the airport, there wasn't much built around. There wasn't much in terms of housing around it. It's kind of sat off by itself in the salt marsh. And, it was initially built in the 1920s, and noise wasn't really a factor at all. But especially, to some extent in the 30s, but especially after World War II, late 1940s, you see tremendous suburban growth in San Mateo County and a lot of and basically suburban housing encroaching closer and closer to the airport. And so earlier in the 50s, you start to see some complaints about aircraft noise in surrounding communities. And then when the jets show up, which are, significantly louder, than you see more, a growing chorus of complaints about the noise. And it's an interesting story because you have all of these suburbs around the airport, for the most part, are very white and exclusionarily white, working and middle class. So you've got people who have been able to take advantage of some of the privileges accorded to whiteness during the post-World War II era, access to good jobs at or near the airport, access to housing that's off limits to other people because of restrictive covenants and the like. But they're finding that the privilege that they're able to access, these people who live near the airport, they are finding this comes with a cost, right? So you've got this interesting dynamic where you've got city officials and business leaders and airport officials who've made decisions that have led to jets being used at the airport. And once they are there and once complaints are being voiced about them, are trying to justify that noise by saying that, well, yeah, this is an inconvenience, but you all who live near the airport are benefiting from this noise, right? I mean, it's kind of a necessary byproduct of the jobs that you have access to at the airport. Or if you don't happen to work at the airport, those workers are spending money in your communities and you're benefiting from their the capital that they're generating, that they're putting into the communities otherwise. And also the airport's convenient. You live, you're 10 miles away and you can go visit your relatives. Or if, there's a medical emergency, we can fly a doctor in to treat you. And they're trying to make this argument to their constituencies that this is, it's an inconvenience that has to be, we have to abide in order to live the lives that we can now live in this region. Whereas you have community members who are just outraged by this. And at this point, this is before there's much effort at all through changing technologies or, EPA and, another governmental regulations on noise pollution and the like. Airplanes are tremendously noisy, and the effects on people's quality of life are tremendous. I mean, they're so loud, aircraft are so loud that they're even breaking windows in people's homes and causing cracks to their plaster walls and the like. Right. So, back to your question about, who is privileged in these discussions, you've got working middle-class people who are kind of marginally privileged, I guess, have some voice by virtue of being white, by being suburban dwellers who are on some level living the American dream and living, kind of adhering to the expectations of what suburban consumerism looks like at this point in time, right? And doing what they're supposed to do, who are able to, I mean, and what I do in the chapter is trace this sort of history of these neighbors of the airport neighbors trying to achieve voice by bringing their complaints to their political representatives and trying to figure out other ways to be heard by the airport. Eventually they turn to the courts and start filing lawsuits against the airport to try to get them to mitigate the noise. They're successful to some extent. They do get heard. They're positioned in a way where they can be. And that becomes even more the case later from the 1970s on, where because of the rerouting of flights and the expansion of airport operations, the noise starts to get heard more profoundly in wealthier neighborhoods. Mm. So you've got people with even more capital participating in the struggle. But, they're only to some extent successful. They make some changes. The airport, airlines, FAA are forced to respond on some level, but people are still complaining today about the noisiness of airport operations.
Right. And the airport's still there, too. So
and the airport's still there, yeah. I mean, there were some people who wanted to shut it down, but that wasn't going to happen.
So other things that come up in the book later on, once we get sort of later into the 20th century, get into the idea of welcoming. And San Francisco has this reputation, again, from afar, that it's a very open and welcoming city, certainly to the LGBTQ2+ community. It's long had that reputation, but also across ethnic lines and linguistic lines, right? It really is kind of this cross-section of the world in a lot of ways because of the, as we talked about earlier, the access, easy access to Asia and Trans-Pacific, but also people coming east from European origins coming eventually to the West Coast. So there's a lot going on, and it has this reputation, the city does, from afar of being welcoming. But the book gets into or kind of challenges that a little bit as it relates to the airport and some of the policies that are put into place. The idea that certain resources, for instance, are distributed unequally and things like environmental protection, which is something else that I think it's heavily associated with California and in particular, the Bay Area. So as we get into the later part of the 20th century, how does the airport or the politics surrounding the airport, the discussions around the airport kind of challenge these perceptions that, again, somebody from 3,500 miles away from San Francisco, but that's at least the perception I have of the city. I think the city's reputation. How does the airport potentially challenge or stories surrounding the airport challenge that reputation?
Yeah. So, I mean, it does so in a number of ways. And, what I was trying to do, I mean, one of the themes in the book, which looks at the airport as a, in some ways as a microcosm of the greater Bay Area, and the airport as an infrastructure that, provides access to mobility and access in different ways, but with limits, right, is to make some commentary about how this, the politics in this region, the liberal and even progressive politics in this region, which, as you put it, was famously defined by its liberal and progressive politics, are often have limits and are contradictory in unexpected ways, right? So, I try to address this in the noise chapter that we were just talking about. This is, people have some successes in blending, kind of suburban NIMBY politics with, sort of an emergent environmentalism, but, they can only go so far. And sometimes when there's successes by one community in getting noise mitigated in their particular area and getting the airport to reroute flights so they don't have such a devastating impact on that community means that another community that may not be so empowered ends up hearing the noise more profoundly. So yeah, in some of these later chapters, I do address this. You mentioned the immigration chapter, and one of the things I do in that chapter is look at the airports as a site for protests for immigrant rights in different registers, or at least as the place where things happen that cause people to protest elsewhere, because people get detained as they're trying to enter the U.S. through SFO. So, you know, one story I tell is the way that starting in the late 80s, circa 1990, San Francisco was an important site for challenging the immigration restrictions directed to people who were HIV positive or who had AIDS, and how a lot of really important activism happened in the Bay Area, particularly around the 1990 AIDS conference, and particularly around the ways that travelers with AIDS were prevented from entering the country. But that some of that activism didn't quite come to terms with the ways that immigrants with AIDS who were trying to come into the country, or undocumented immigrants with AIDS who were HIV positive, were in danger of deportation, or either initially, for the first group not being allowed in the country, not being allowed to join up with family members and what have you, and then people who had been here and whose visa status had lapsed, or who were never documented, were in danger of being deported, and how there was sort of a second wave of activism trying to address their situation, and some of those activists pushed back on what they saw as the inadequacy of this earlier wave of activism for, you know, addressing the needs of more marginalized people with AIDS, and how they were being positioned by the immigration apparatus. So again, just one example of how, you know, there was, even in something really heroic, there was a kind of, you know, one mode of activism that was really important and heroic, there was a kind of an exclusion built into there, sort of baked into that.
So that leads to me to a question of what is really the relationship between the airport and, I mean, the book is a people's history, right? So the airport and the people in the community, so San Francisco writ large, and the people who use the airport. Like, how do you navigate those different constituencies, the different reasons why people are concerned about the airport, using the airport, being around the airport? Like, in these issues, as you say, it's locals who are protesting or commenting on things that are happening at the airport from people who are not from San Francisco, who are trying to come into San Francisco. So in a lot of cases, these are people who've never met each other, and but there's this interconnectedness. So how do you try to assess that, where you have people in the community, but also people using it who are coming from away? It's just, it strikes me as a challenge to try to navigate all those various perspectives.
Yeah, challenge. Definitely. Yeah, I mean, so I guess in some cases, like the one I was just talking about, you do see, and I did try to write about the common cause being made by people who were sort of here, local community members, activists, and those who wanted to come here or were prevented from coming to the Bay Area, I should say. So that's a connection easy to make and document, because, I mean, there are records, right? There are ACT UP records and, minutes from meetings and correspondence that shows those connections and journalistic coverage of those interactions. In other cases, the connections are, I guess, less clear and less easy to track. And the focus really is on the Bay Area and people in the Bay Area and how they interact with the airport. And sometimes the traveler is just the kind of social economic force, right?
Yeah.
That people contend with, right? And, there are all these people who use the airport, and, sometimes it's us, right? I'm, mm-hmm. Speaking from the voice of a Bay Area person, who uses the airport as a traveler, right? And sometimes it's just the people who are passing through or doing business here or being tourists here. And then, those people kind of get abstracted into what they represent, right? Money coming into communities, right? Because of all this, because of this use of the airport and all the people, who fly in and out of it, then that generates all this capital, which then shapes the economy, or they generate all this noise that shapes people have to deal with, or they cause all this environmental harm that local environmental activists have to contend with, environmental harm beyond noise,
sure.
In the form of, air pollution and degradation of the San Francisco Bay. And, ultimately, because of the huge amount of carbon released into the atmosphere through burning of fossil fuels for aviation, among other things, climate change.
I'm curious, as somebody who has written a book, and as we talked about before we started to record, I love airports. You're more muted or more neutral on airports than I guess I am. but how do you now consider the place of SFO, right? You say you're from the Bay Area, you've used the airport. Has going through this process, writing this book, like now when you walk through the airport and travel and use it, does it change the way you think of that and your relationship with the airport?
I think it has in some ways. I mean, I think it's given me more of an appreciation for it as a complex infrastructure that somehow works.
yeah.
Even though I've learned a lot of things that, would make one critical of SFO or any airport in terms of, the exploitative labor conditions that happen at all airports by definitions, because of, again, their harmful effects on the environment. But, I've done things like, I've read a lot of documents created by the airport regarding, say, sustainability programs. Even though a lot of exploitative work happens there, I mean, SFO is one of those airports that's actually done some significant things to try to better the working conditions for at least some people who work there. I mean, not to discount the critiques that workers still have and that the unions that represent them still have. I mean, it is like other airports, a site of ongoing labor struggles. But sure, there have been some interesting programs instituted there tied to the broader cities and regions' efforts to create living, try in different ways to bring some of its, institute living wage campaigns. Some interesting things that have happened regarding that. What else? I don't know. I learned more about the public art and museum program there. I mean, San Francisco Airport is famous for its public art. I mean, there's been a lot of ink spilled in the press about its public art and museum program, and its museum program has won awards for the quality of its exhibitions. And I had noticed them before and had been interested in them. But I learned more about them and learned more about the history and just the really impressive number, a range of the exhibits that have happened there. I guess I've had a renewed appreciation. And when I haven't flown that many times since writing the book, but when I have flown out of SFO and have had time, I've lingered on them more.
Yeah. And it is a beautiful airport, as you say. One of the longest flights, not in time, but in experience, was one from Boston to San Francisco for me. And it was a layover in San Francisco and just walking around, looking at all the art It's a really beautiful, beautiful location. It was very cool for me to see that this book come out, get a little better sense of the history of the airport beyond just the airport where you are. So we'd highly recommend the book. It's A People's History of SFO, The Making of the Bay Area and an Airport. Eric, if people wanted to pick up a copy of the book, what is the best way for them to do that?
I think the best way is to go to the University of California Press website, and there are a few different buying options.
Yes, and available in paperback too, which I'm always available a fan of. I'm a paperback guy. I am not a big hardcover guy, so really love that it's already available in paperback. There's also an ebook available. We'll link to the University of California Press site below if you want to check it out. So Eric, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking with you.
So there you have it, my chat with Eric Porter, and I thank him for his time. And again, it's A People's History of SFO, The Making of the Bay Area and an Airport. As I say, we will link to that in the show notes below. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the local affiliate of CBS in the Bay Area, written by Tim Fang, titled City Files Motion to Stop OAK Airport from Using San Francisco Bay Name. And this is a really interesting story where San Francisco officials filed a motion in court to stop the Oakland International Airport from using San Francisco Bay in its name. The claim is that travelers have confused the airport in Oakland for SFO. And they're claiming that travelers, by not knowing exactly where they're going based on this name, are being deceived and duped. And that is profitable for the Oakland airport, which is why they would use that in their name. And it's taking routes and passenger travel away from SFO. And we see this in other parts of the world. Certainly when you're looking at where I live here in Ottawa, there are places in upstate New York that really try to brand themselves as airports for Ottawa. You have to drive there. It's an hour or two away, but cheaper airfare usually by flying domestically in the United States. So this is a strategy that you see used elsewhere, but it's something that obviously SFO does not like and is trying to get in front of. Now, the airport was renamed in April, and the Port of Oakland officials approved it, claiming a lack of, quote, geographic awareness among out-of-town visitors about where Oakland is and the fear that they were losing routes to SFO. The Port of Oakland has filed a countersuit against San Francisco, claiming that the name does not infringe on the trademark of SFO and that nobody has trademark rights to the San Francisco Bay. So this just happened September the 17th. I thought very timely given what we're talking about on the show, but it really goes to show just how important airports are, the power of airports, and clearly that Oakland wants to get into or get greater access to the amount of people coming to the greater Bay Area. So these issues, as Eric was talking about, still very contentious, still very powerful, and the subject of today's historical headline of the week from CBS News Bay Area, written by Tim Fang, City Files Motion to Stop OAK Airport from Using San Francisco Bay Name. And with that, I will say thank you very much, everybody, for listening. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your shows. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find us, keeps us growing. And as always, head on over to activehistory.ca for all the great written material there on the website. Site is back fully going from the summer hiatus. Great material over there. And of course, all of our past episodes are available under the podcast tab. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, it's oldestnews@gmail.com. So with that, I will thank you again for listening. We'll be back with you again next Wednesday for more What's Old as News.